Just on this note too, just because of now we're talking about it, now I'm all fired up. I was watching a video for Pace Morby a while ago.
Yeah.
And he was talking about, he's like, look at this, a due on sale clause happened and we're just doing a deed reversal. So essentially I'm going to deed it back to the seller and the seller's going to deed it back to me at a later date. It's like, that sounds like a pain in the ass.
That also sounds like fraud. You already got called on something and they're like, you can't do that. And you're like, okay. What's going on, guys? Welcome to today's episode of the Collecting Keys Real Estate Investing Podcast. This is the show where we teach you to make massive income, not just passive income, but with your real estate business. If this is your first time here, I am Mike DeHaan. I'm here with my co-host, Dan Austin.
Ew.
And this is Wednesday. This is the Mike and Dan show where we talk about real estate investing, business, and whatever else we have going on this week. So, we are middle of January, off to a pretty decent start. We got, five contracts on the month. We got a bunch of closings between now and February 2nd. I think, eight closings we have in our pipeline right now. We got a bunch of new sales staff that have come on, or just like staff in general that have come in. And I don't know, it feels like in the last 2 weeks, we have kind of accomplished more than we did in all of Q4. Yeah. I don't know, if that's just us coming rejuvenated from the holiday or the team has been getting after it.
I think it's just more wisdom and where we need to go. You know, if you think about this, the concept of goal setting or whatever you want to, something like that, you need to spend more time in building the strategy and understanding where you want to go and figuring out what you want. And then once you know that, you just have to take the steps. And I think as business owners, we've kind of finally figured out how to really truly set strategy.
Yeah.
And understand where we want to go and why we want to go there. And so now it's just easier to execute on opportunity when we see it. Because it's not like we didn't lack opportunity. And it's not like a lot of people don't lack opportunity. It's they just lack focus and understanding which opportunity is the right one for them.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. You say it's important to plan. I would say most people, they never get anywhere because they spend too much time planning, right? They never take action.
Yeah. And I shouldn't say it's important. I'm not saying it's important to plan. I'm saying it's important to get out of the planning phase. Because if you don't have a strategy, All you're doing is planning and thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're like, I think this is what I want, or I think this is where I want to go. I'm going to set this goal. But you're just you're not actually getting to where you need to be.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Which is at taking action.
Yeah.
Because you're so, and you see this a lot, especially towards the end of the year when you're talking to people trying to set their goals, is they never get out of that. And the difference between people that are like a rocket ship when they do is because they have, they know where they're going. They have some experience and they're ready to rock and roll. And it's just step one, step two, step three, where if you're stuck in this I don't know phase where you're just shiny objects, which path do I take? It feels slow and muddy and you're just not going anywhere.
Totally. And I think that becomes a skill once you sort of learn to take action a little bit quicker and put things together. You realize how most things that you think are probably overcomplicated really aren't. You know, we talked about adding in cold calling to our lead generation. A lot of people spend months trying to find a VA or a cold caller to come work for them. We got a whole team up and running in mm-hmm. 6 days. Didn't even know how to use the software, anything like that. You just leverage the education that's already out there that other people have put together to teach your team. And you just say here's the expectations. Here's what you need to do. You go and you find the people and you do it, you know? And then Sam, we talked about bringing in a disposition manager to help move some of our deals or to help, you know, move some deals for people in our scale community because we set up a pretty sweet relationship with Investor Lift so that people that are in our scale community get these heavily discounted seats. Not everyone wants that. So we brought in somebody that could help people get the advantage of Investor Lift without needing to necessarily have their own accounts or buy into the group system that we have. So we brought someone in for that. And that was we posted the job listing, found someone 2 weeks later.
How fast did we have them start? 3 weeks, 4 weeks total?
So now, dude, I listed that job listing after the new year. So it's currently January 16th.
I guess I was thinking a concept to close. It was 3 or 4 weeks. Cause we had kind of talked about the dispo stuff, but we were okay, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it.
Mm-hmm. And then we just executed. About 4 weeks there. And so you started with us now. That'll be another vertical for the business that we'll have bring in. It'll also really increase our ability to make money on deals that come through when our partners aren't interested in stuff. So that'll be massive.
Collecting Keys Dispo Shop coming to a market near you. If you have deals that you want to see if we can dispo, we'll do it for a flat fee. Just hit us up and we'll see if our guy can do it for you.
Well, that's the whole thing, right? Is and this is the opportunity that we recognize is we have so many people in scale and so we've known around the country in general that will have these different people that bring them buyers, daisy chain their deals for like 50%, doesn't make any sense. And we're like, what if we just did that for like a flat fee? Mm-hmm. Because it's really not, it's not worth the 50% that people pay for. That's a ridiculous thing for somebody to go and make this connection.
No. So back in the day, even where we started, like your email list and your contact list mm-hmm. for wholesaling was huge, right? Like no, but like if you shared your buyer's list, people would be like, oh my God, you screwed up, right? It was a big deal because that's who you sold your deals to. And if other people had those buyers and they were worried that you wouldn't be able to sell them deals. Well, now, I mean, with software and some tech, all that information is public anyways. And so now they just basically, Investor Lift has created that, put it behind a massive paywall exactly. that most people can't afford. And we're able to, fortunately, just because of where we're set up in our business, be able to buy the full version with whatever they call God mode and Artemis mode. So you don't have to do the legwork of building yep. your list. It's already there. And so now it just makes it a little bit easier for people. It's still, if you don't have the contact list, you still can't dispo to those people. So now you can pay to get there.
Yeah. So either way, we got that up and running, which has been, you know, really quick transition. And same thing, we're just utilizing Investor Lift's pre-built training, putting him through that and, you know, establishing with our connecting with our already established connections, which makes it easy. And I think that like one of my favorite quotes, I think it's a Hormozy quote is, big decisions don't have to take a long time. People just choose to make them take a long time, right? And that's so true, like with a lot of these things is, in the reality, what most of us are trying to do is not inherently complicated. People just choose to make them complicated because they don't fully understand them. Uh-huh. And even right before this recording, I was on a online marketing call for GoBundance. They have like a new micro tribe for people that have online communities. And I was on there, right? It was great information.
I heard about that, yeah.
But the guy was going through like social media ads and like different things like that. And I'm sitting there and this call is like 30 people in there. And I'm looking at all these guys. I know a lot of these names that are on there because it's a relatively small community. And I'm like, why the fuck are these guys that are all worth millions of dollars? Like you have to be to qualify for GoBundance. Why are they in like a technical seminar learning to run online ads? It doesn't make sense. Because like what are they going to like take a break yeah. from their business that makes them money to now go and run ads? Why don't they have a marketing manager this uh-huh. year? Right? Or why is there like not some way that they can use to teach this to somebody in their company when instead like they're here and they're going to like remember this information and go back and be like to their assistant like, oh, hey,
yeah.
I learned about this thing called a pixel and like I need you to go like research that now because I just wasted an hour on an educational call, teaching me the technical skills that are not applicable to the entrepreneur. Like if you're like a solopreneur, that's one thing, but all these people on there, they have like legitimate businesses. I don't know if it's like the school system or the way that we're brought right. up or whatever, but like there's kind of this view that you have to like really be proficient on things before you can hire someone to do it. And that just doesn't make sense like at all.
Yeah, I'm a good example of that. I try not to be proficient at things on purpose.
You don't try, you succeed.
Because I know my personality.
Yeah, right.
You suck at everything. Well, like I learned early on, I used to be that way, especially as an engineer. Like, mm-hmm. oh, I need to design it. I have to build it and design it. It's like, well, in reality, engineering's not that. Engineering is copying and pasting other people's stuff. And so sometimes I get too deep into that sort of stuff and I don't even like engineering, right? But it's like, for me, I wanted to create and understand how to do it. And then as I stepped into like more leadership roles and managerial roles throughout my career, I realized I didn't need to, and I didn't want to be the expert at a lot of stuff because there's other people that really truly care to be the expert at social media or at whatever it is. And I can think more clearly on strategic things, and I enjoy the strategic problem solving over the tactical problem solving.
For sure. And some people don't like that. Some people like the tactical and being in the weeds and all that sort of stuff, and that's fine. Uh-huh. But I think one of the problems is you have a lot of people who like to be at the higher level, who still kind of have ingrained in them that they need to be in the weeds, like learning all the hard skills, mm-hmm. which isn't true. You know, and sometimes people figure that out. And a lot of people that have W-2s, you hear this where they go like, God, my freaking boss doesn't know anything about this. Like, why is he telling me how to do this? It's like, you're right. He doesn't. You literally are there because he doesn't know how to do it.
That's why you have a job.
Yeah. If he's asking you questions, it's usually because he doesn't understand or you're not relaying it correctly or you're not meeting his expectations. Sometimes that's because, you know, a lack of communication. Sometimes it's like a lack of him setting those expectations for you. But I think one of the things that the entrepreneur, the higher level one that always will have going for them is that most people, they like to be in the weeds. And so the person that's in the weeds is always going to be more replaceable than like the thought leader. right? Or the person that's actually at the ship.
Sure.
It's a different skill set, you know, and it's a hard thing to kind of comprehend, I would say, until you've sort of been in that role anyway.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, it's one of those things where the way I guess I summarize it too is the CEO of the business doesn't know what most of their employees do, but somehow they're still setting the vision for the company.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating too, because you'll always hear like, oh, that guy doesn't know at all what he's talking about. There's no way this is possible. But then, you know, 6 months into a project, mm-hmm. something becomes possible because this vision was set and it was pushed. It's like, this is where we're going. You get people to buy in and believe into that. And that's kind of the hard thing with like small business is making sure you're doing that. A lot of folks that listen to this might be solopreneurs, might be the only person in their business. Like, well, how do I get to that point? Like, I'm still just grinding. And it's like, yeah, sometimes you do have to be the technician because you started out as the sole person in your business, but it's really still setting the vision for yourself and then understanding what steps you need to take to like hire that first employee, yeah. that first staff member.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the challenges is, you know, when you're going from that solopreneur to entrepreneur shift, and this is especially true in the real estate industry because we already deal with a cash crunch all the time and you're starting out anyway, there's always like a huge shift between your money going out when it comes back. And that challenge compounds the efforts and the difficulties of trying to like get out of the business and sort of bring in people because you constantly, not only do you not have the time, you also feel like you don't have the money or you need to have the money available for opportunities that come through. And so realistically, what you need to do is like get super lucky and have like a big win that you can just like bank a ton of cash, right? Or you need to like accumulate your little reserve for a while to be able to bring somebody on. That's hard to do. You need to spend the money kind of before you have it, which is what we did. We brought on our first sales manager. We literally didn't have enough to pay them for their first month. And we just said, well, they better make some money or it's going to be really awkward, right? Or you need to be willing to pay yourself significantly less, which is the one that most people are really have a hard time giving up. And that's just part of like being a business owner, right? Is you're going to have variable pay. That again goes back to kind of like the traditional expectations.
What about profit first, man? Everybody's talking about profit first. Pay yourself first, dude.
Yeah, of course. Respect your time. You're a brand new business owner. Your time's valuable. It's fucking trash, dude.
There's a lot of that stuff out there that you're like, yeah, even like there's a lot of, and you and I like subscribe to a lot of it, but you kind of have to earn it. Like we tried profit first when we first started. We're like, where the fuck is the profit? We don't have profit, right? Because you're reinvesting it, right? But so many people, they want to be like, well, I'm supposed to pay myself first. And there's a lot to be said about that, right? However, when you're trying to build something, and to your point, you're trying to build up some reserves so you can take advantage of opportunities. You might not get to profit first. You might reinvest first and there may not be a lot. And I know that there's some people out there like the purists are like, oh, you can still take a percentage. And it's like, probably, but who cares about 20 bucks? You know what I mean? You know, but then like the who, not how, it's like, well, sometimes you do have to be the who and you have to be the how, right? All at the same time. But the goal should be is understanding what you're going through, setting the vision. So when you can grow out of that and then you can start applying each of these different elements that we learn, you know, on the podcast, you know, the MBA podcast where they teach you all these sorts of things of how to be a business owner.
Well, the thing is with a lot of those like books or sort of methodologies, whatever, think of like they exist because the people behind them are trying to sell you something. They have some sort of like coaching thing, certification, you know, more books, whatever it is that they're trying to sell you. And the main people that are going to aggressively consume that, whatever they're trying to sell, are the people that are new and are trying to like figure out business and, or they are people that are like very small and they're trying to like figure out how to grow, right? So like even if they've been doing it for a while, they're like a really small business and they're working a ton. And those sort of things, like you need to always pay yourself first. Like, you know, you need to like make sure that you're respecting your own time, like all the different things people do. That's the most sexy to people that don't fully understand the game yet.
Yeah.
Right. And like when you have people that are kind of like, I don't know, entrepreneurs that have been in for a while. How often do you hear like dudes like Aaron Amuchastegui, who's been an entrepreneur for like his whole life, talking about freaking profit first? He doesn't.
Yeah.
It's a ridiculous thing. And he's like, yeah, some years I make $3 million, other years I make $200,000, other years I lose my ass. And that's kind of the way the business goes, right? And that's honestly a lot of entrepreneurs that have been around for a while, or like even like larger ones, smaller ones, whatever. Like those things that people get really excited about, and there's nothing wrong with like understanding them and like sort of seeing the message trying to portray. It's like more when people take them as gospel, I would say they inhibit your growth because you're too focused on trying to follow a regiment that isn't necessarily going to encourage you to take the risk that you need to probably take to get out of your own way.
Totally. Absolutely. And like, and because there's so many people out there, like with these books and, you know, these new concepts, and when you're, you know, like, I feel like you and I are pretty forward in being open and trying to help, you know, learn things ourselves. And like, we join different groups and masterminds and stuff like that. So naturally there's all that kind of like stuff in there where people want to talk about that. Cause it's like improving, like, oh, this is how I figured out how to work out of my business, this book, Who Not How. And so then the next thing you know, some dude's read every single Dan Sullivan book that ever existed. And they're great, not to talk shit about them. But like, for me personally, I'm kind of a slow learner. If I can learn like one new concept a year, like if at the end of the year, I had this like total epiphany where I'm like, that's kind of what I picked up the last 12 months. I'm pretty pumped, right? Like the learning the who, not how might not be it for the early stage company. And we might say we sell out collecting keys and that applies to us at this point, but it might not apply to us on the next business we start. And now looking back after, you know, you and I have ran, you know, a couple different businesses now, I would look at it as starting a business. So I'd be like, yeah, okay. So like maybe 24, 36 months, if we're lucky, we'll be taking a good salary. You know, I wouldn't be like, as soon as I can, like, yes, I'm taking a salary 12 months. That'll be, no, realistically, I'm going to bank on 24 to 36 months that I won't get a paycheck.
The problem is most people have the expectation that they need to be replacing their exact income that they were making at typically their high paying W-2. If they're in a position that they're even thinking about getting into entrepreneurship,
they're able to do that. Yep.
Right. And so they're like, man, I make $165 a year at this job. Like, I need to be able to replace that before I can leave. Why?
Totally. Yeah. And you don't have to. And the other thing about that is too, is like this, well, the idea of not having income, I'm not saying that to be like, you're not going to make any income in your business for 3 years, but you shouldn't have the expectation that you're going to your point, replace whatever income you had before. And in the first 6 months or 12 months, or that is the mark of success right there. Because there's some businesses that they take a while to develop. And real estate, because what we're doing in the off-market real estate business is, first thing is real estate's expensive to buy, right? It's just, you run out of money eventually. And finding deals, we're running marketing businesses. And our marketing, unfortunately, costs money. Whether you're doing, I don't know any marketing out there that's free other than, I guess, you going out and beating the pavement, but that does have cost. But you know, SEO is going to cost you money. The more you spend on that, the more deals you're going to get. Direct mail is going to cost you money. Cold calling is going to cost, everything's going, all this outbound and inbound marketing costs money. So it's a heavy expense. And so when we talk about reinvesting in the business, that might simply mean instead of paying yourself an additional $5,000, you're pumping an additional $5,000 into marketing, investing in that to grow more your lead flow. That's kind of what we're talking about here. And that's why it's like always a cash crunch. And you may not get to replace your $165,000 your salary in 12 months because you're growing your pipeline.
Yeah. And I think the challenge is that a lot of people, they don't like investing that money or putting in the time if they don't know that they have a guaranteed outcome, right? And the problem is I would say if that's realistically you, you're probably not meant to be an entrepreneur. Right. Like, honestly, like, unless it's something where you're like, you're billing hourly or you're like, I don't know, more like a hustlepreneur type, then you could probably get by. But if you want to like grow a business and you want to make business investments, you want to spend money on marketing, you want to try and grow a team, you will spend money back on expected returns, but not like guaranteed returns. Like that. That's why when you look at like publicly traded companies, they'll have things like, oh, this company's earnings exceeded expectations. Because they didn't fucking know either.
Yeah.
Right? And like, because that's why it's called an expectation. Like they were, expecting the money to come back. And sometimes they're like, damn, we did good. And other times we're like, uh-oh, that was really bad.
Yeah.
You know?
Whoops, that CEO is getting fired.
Yeah, and that's how business works, right? Mm-hmm. So.
Right. Yeah, I would say to me, for me, if I was to share like a learning opportunity, going back to this kind of conversation of like, oh, I might not take a salary for 12 months or whatever, is that my timeline is much longer when I'm making that investment. Mm-hmm. So if I choose to say pay $10,000 in marketing or $10,000 to join a mastermind, I'm going to have a different timeline for each of those. And I'm okay with the timeline being longer than instant or next month. So if I join a mastermind for $10,000 to learn how to buy off-market real estate or buy a business, whatever, that's a big hot topic. I'm not expecting to do that in a month or even a year. It might be 2 years before that comes to fruition and I'm okay with that just because I've learned that sometimes where I thought I spent money that just didn't hold value, looking back on it, it did hold value. It was just a longer timeline.
Yeah. And that's, you know, when it comes to buying a business, right, making real estate investments as well, that's such a valid point because so many people, they analyze opportunities off of what it's doing right now not of what its potential is. Mm-hmm. You know, you see this all the time with people that are like, well, I can't buy this property. It's currently negative cash flow. It's like, you know, and there's tenants that are in there until June. It's like, well, buy it as a negative cash flow property. Make sure you have some good equity so it's worth your downside. Get the tenants out in June, fix it up, increase the rent rate. There you go. Now you're making money, right? It's a longer term time horizon and your gain over that period of time will vastly exceed the bleeding that you do for 6 months. And then same with like a business. I see this a lot in like different Facebook groups and stuff that I'm in now where they're like, oh, I'm looking at this business. The problem is that like last year, because of like different things, it only made this much money, you know? So I don't think it's like a very good investment like at all. And I'm like, well, that's probably because the systems were crap. They probably didn't have a good internal manager. They don't have any sort of growth plan. Yep. Your job is not to just like buy this thing and have it print off money. Your job is to come in, instill stability, and grow it with the potential that's there and whatever the industry is, the established brand, whatever that company has. And that's where you make your return. It's not like you just like buy it and you're immediately getting a, you know, 50% cash on cash return. That's exactly not how anything works.
Exactly. That's not usually how it works. And that's why you're buying it.
It is. You know, when you hear people like talk about that on podcasts, it's because A, they found a unicorn, or B, they're a liar. Like, honestly.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, it's just interesting. But anyways, yeah, that's been something that we've been, I guess, dealing a lot with people in our scale community as they're sort of going through those growing pains. It's part of every small business. You know, you kind of either got to get used to it or do something else, just to be honest. So anyways, well, I want to talk about the sub-2 deal that we heard us talk about over the past few weeks where we had these loans get called and on these duplexes. So in case you missed those.
This is called subject to TOO.
TOO, and that's not.
Like two.
It's definitely not what it is.
Like we're doing it
too. Yeah, we're doing it too. Yeah, right. But if you guys missed that, bought these properties, these three duplexes, and we bought them subject to, basically subject to the existing mortgages. We did not assume the loan. Subject to does not mean you assume the loan, because that means the loan is transferred to you.
You don't even assume the liability of the loan, which is pretty cool, right?
I know. Yeah, exactly. So if you've seen Pace Morby, whatever, you've seen all this bullshit everywhere. Anyway, the number one thing that all these, I don't know, fanboys for this process out there say is that you never have to worry about the due on sale clause, because lenders never call that. And the due on sale clause is basically the clause that's in every loan document that's ever existed that says the property sells, you have the right to call the loan. The subject to people say, you don't have to worry about that because it never happens. We bought these three properties literally like 4 days later. We get a call from the lender and they call the loan due. So it's like $580K that they're demanding due right away. Okay. And we go back to them and we say, listen, we're experienced investors. Our plan is to sell these properties. Can we keep your loans due? Can we take over the payments? Like, what would you like us to do to make sure that this is an easy transition? And they basically gave us like two middle fingers and we're like, you better figure it out, fuckers. Right. Yeah.
And didn't even want to communicate, no. But then also wanted to spend a bunch of money on their end on foreclosure costs and all that bullshit.
I know all this bullshit. Yeah. And so after 6 weeks of this, and then finally you kind of like strong armed them last week when they were really being difficult. And you were like, listen, yeah. If you're going to be this, like, we'll just deed them back to the seller and then you can foreclose on
him. The dude that was failing to pay these loans, by the way.
All these loans are underwater when we bought them. That was the whole point, was our plan was to get these properties, get them caught up and then flip the houses. And we just said, we'll just give it back to the previous owner, the guarantor in your loan. And you can deal with that. And then all of a sudden they were like, whoa. Let's not do that.
Like, let's not go that far.
Yeah. And they sent us these payoff statements that had all these like legal fees and all these penalties and stuff. They were trying to pass off to us. And we're like, no, like if you had talked to us 6 weeks ago, we wouldn't have any of these, but you were unreasonable. Uh-huh. And so anyway, they were like, what is your number?
Basically, what is your offer?
What is your offer?
We should have gone lower, damn it.
We could have. So I was trying to not be a dick about it, right? Because I wanted them to accept
totally.
It.
Like, we were above board this whole time. We're like trying to be like, hey, we're here to help like the guy who we took these over from. And we're lenders as well. Like, we get it. You don't want to lose your money. So we're going to work with you. Just work
exactly,
with us.
Yeah. So I went through and I backdated everything to be the interest up to the day that we bought the property, right? And I was like, we're willing to pay you this much. You know, it'll get you paid off square. And then you can, you know, do whatever you want to do. And after, I don't know, 5 days of that, they finally came back and were like, fine, we'll do it. And so we were able to finally get them paid off. Bunch of headache for nothing. And then looking at the different numbers that they have. They spent a bunch of money on like lawyers and like different things. So now they are losing money because they decided to be dissed for 6 weeks.
Like 40 G's they're going to lose on this, which is like 10% of the loan value damn near. Like honestly.
If they had just not been ridiculous from the get-go, everyone would be better off.
Once they release their liens on these properties, I think 100% we should do an email to our favorite guy over there at this specific lender and be like, man, I bet you wish you weren't being a jackass now, and then just leave it at that.
No shit. Yeah.
Be like, you just lost your investors 40 grand. How does that
feel? Outrageous. You know, it's just, and like literally from day one, we were so just like transparent about the entire situation. We put all our cards out there and they were just like, they would never talk to us on the phone. They would like respond to our email like only like once a day, like every few days at like weird hours with like one line sentences. I'm sure they had something where there's like, our attorney says we're not supposed to accidentally share too much information.
Something
I'm
stupid.
Like, figure it out.
Well, it's not like they're a big lender. It's not like they're a Bank of America. Like this wasn't a, I mean, they're a decent size, but they're not like a massive lender. And so I would be, you know, fortunately we were able to, you know, we were liquid enough and able to get the funds to pay these guys off immediately. They just didn't want us to, right? For whatever reason. I think they just wanted to stick it to us. I think there was a partner there that was just being a jackass, which is fine. But if you're going subject to and a big time lender, which is a lot of these people get, you know, these loans originate because you're not, this was in, like an investor that we took these from. So it's a, it was a different product in general. But like, could you imagine trying to communicate with somebody at Bank of America or Wells Fargo, one of the biggest mortgage, you know, originators in the country, and like trying to explain to them what happened? Like, I don't care. And in general, I will say, the reason why Pace Morby loves subject to, and he's quoted saying this all over the internet, is like, I would never put my name on the as a guarantor for debt. Why would I do that? And so the due on sale clause, in his opinion, doesn't matter because truly doesn't matter, right? You could just walk away and say, I don't know. Like, yeah, whatever. That's this guy's loan, not my loan. And the guy you bought it from subject to, or the person you bought it from subject to, is the one in trouble because 4 years later they get it called and like, wait, what? Holy crap. And there's a good chance you weren't paying.
Yeah, well, see, that's why it's shady in general too, right? Is you fully have the ability to completely screw over the seller and they'll be none the wiser until all of a sudden they're getting sued, right?
Exactly.
But yeah, you have all these like dipshits that are out there peddling these things because they don't fully understand or care about that.
Yeah.
And like, we could have very easily done that in this situation. If we were like, we don't want to deal with this, we could have just deeded it back to the seller or just like let it go. And were they going to come take the properties, not be made whole anyway, and then go and sue him? But he doesn't have anything. He was already failing.
Yeah. Just on this note too, just because of now we're talking about it and now I'm all fired up. I was watching a video for Pace Morby a while ago, and he was talking about, he's like, look at this, a due on sale clause happened and we're just doing it. We're just doing a deed reversal. So essentially I'm going to deed it back to the seller and the seller's going to deed it back to me at a later date. It's like, that sounds like a pain in the ass.
That also sounds like fraud. You already got called on something and they're like, you can't do that. And you're like, okay, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to wait till you're not looking. Then I'm going to do it again.
I'm going to do it again. And the seller is like, wait, what are you doing? Like,
yeah,
most people don't understand subject to. Most people don't understand any of this. And so you explain it, a process to them. And however you explain it to them, say you explain it above board and everything was exact. They knew exactly what they're getting into. And then 2 years later, you're having to, hey, man, by the way, I'm going to have to give you this property back. And then I'm going to sign it back over to me like 2 weeks later, like that. That doesn't leave a feel good to me with that seller.
No, you know, and like that whole process, think about it, it's exactly the same as like a kid. Like they know they're not supposed to be, you know, stealing a cookie out of the cookie jar.
Mm-hmm.
If they wait, so their mom catches them and they go, oh, I'm not going to do that. And then the second that their mom's not there, they go to like do it again and hope that mom doesn't see. It's like, already on the radar. She's already counting how many cookies there are. You do it again, she's going to catch you, dumbass.
Seriously. And it reminds me of like, you see some of these like rental fraud or like even OA where it wasn't fraud necessarily, but the like landlords were getting foreclosed on and the tenants were like, I've been paying my landlord rent. Like you certainly have, but guess what?
You're
get
fine.
Out because you don't own this house and neither do they.
Yeah. Well, you're seeing that a lot with like lease to owns because they were collecting these large down payments and those are recorded on title. And then the landlord would just like take the money and run. They'd be like, I was paying it. Like, I don't know. Why I'm losing the property. I'm like, yeah, you're right. Well, the bank's not taking it back from the landlord and your lease to own is like the secondary loan to the title, like the fucking whatever.
Yeah, they're in second position. Yeah. They're in a lower position. You know what else you could be a lower position than? Federal taxes.
Yeah. Yeah, right. It's a lot of stuff.
So guy doesn't pay, guy pays his mortgage, but he doesn't pay his taxes. I mean, they're going to get a lien on it. You're going to be behind that.
But you know what blows my mind though? And everyone's probably heard this, but it's crazy. Is like the fact that the pinnacle of like the liens that you can have that's above everything else is freaking HOA liens.
Yeah, are they really?
Oh yeah, dude. Like that'll even come over like first position liens from banks in like certain situations. And that was a whole thing. Imagine some legislation around. I remember hearing this a while back where there was like in some of these states where they have, you know, racism, which is a very big problem in the United States. You know, we're pretty good with that in the Northwest. A lot of places don't have that. You were having these like white HOAs that would have someone of ethnicity move into the neighborhood and they would start like being like, oh, you have a lien, your grass is like an inch too short, too long. They were like doing all things. Yeah. And then basically what they would do is like, oh, yeah, you violated the HOA for too long. We're just going to take your property back from you. And
yeah,
they were doing that.
I also feel like HOAs like where we live at specifically don't really do anything.
They don't do anything.
I don't understand why we have them. I feel like there's a reason why we have them, like from like a planning and zoning standpoint, and there's got to be like a loophole or something that they get by having HOAs. But yeah, they don't do anything. I had a guy talking about he wants to move into my neighborhood and there's an empty lot, and I was like, so how's the HOA? I was like, I have no idea. Never talked to him.
Yeah, you see it a little bit more, I think, in certain places, but up where I don't see
it. Yeah, it's not
really. It's just because people don't want like people to have pit bulls. That's like the one thing that they're hard on is
that's why they hate pit bulls. I think my HOA does say that. Or my old one said you can't have a pit bull.
Dude, they all say that. That's like the one thing. And besides that, they're like, yeah, you can leave trash in your yard. We don't care. But if you have a pit bull.
Yeah, we don't care.
Yeah.
You can park on your grass. Nobody cares.
Yeah.
My biggest problem, my HOA, where they don't do it much, is like there's a lot of people that park boats and campers in the driveway because they have lots of excess income apparently to buy the giant boats and campers, and they can't fit them in their driveways, so they park out on the streets, you know, whether, you know, in the summertime or whatever. I'm like, where's the HOA now? The blind corner. I can't see around this dude's 40-foot boat.
Yeah, right. That is funny. Yeah, we get it, Dan. You live in a nice neighborhood. People have boats where you live. Must be nice.
Shut up. That's not my point.
Anyways. Yeah, so I'm just glad to finally have a conclusion to that. Well, I mean, as of time of recording, I wired the money to pay them off like 2 hours ago. So it should be good. We have plenty of time for it to still turn into a fucking disaster. So if
I hope they give us lien release documents here in the next few days.
So the only reason that I'm feel good about that is because we are going to the note servicing company and they're technically the ones that do all that. Right.
Yeah.
So,
we should be good.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not like we're sending them money directly and it's going to get real dicey. But yeah, so that's that. But if you're doing sub-2 deals out there, be cautious. Loans do get called. And it's not like they tell you, we're like, oh, the lender doesn't want to have to deal with it. Like, they'll just be really easy to work with.
Yeah.
No, they'll make it a pain in your ass.
So here's my question then. I mean, we've talked about sub-2 deals a while. We even have a subject-2 course. If you go to collectingkeys.com/sub-2, in any form or fashion you want to spell 2, you'll find it, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So we do talk about it, but we talk more about like what people, you know, should just be aware of and that isn't being talked about. So my question is, would you, not this sub-2 deal, but would you do a different sub-2 deal?
I do more of them for sure.
Yeah.
I think the reason we got bid on this one, like the circumstances with the seller who was already having problems, definitely was already on their radar.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a big thing.
The loans were already due and all that sort of stuff. Like there was problems with it.
Yeah. He was already behind on them and there was a whole dilemma. So they were already kind of monitoring it. Secondly, it was a investor grade lender, so it's a DSCR lender. So they're naturally going to see that anyway compared to like a Fannie Freddie lender. You know, someone that sells to the federal government, you're less likely to get seen because you're just going to a portfolio. They don't really care. But those are the two main things that I would be like very cautious of.
You'd want to know who the lender is.
Yeah, want to know who the lender is, want to get more details on those sort of situations. And then I think the big thing is if you want to do subject to correctly, and this is a big thing that we go into in the course at collectingkeys.com/sub-2 is around how to actually structure the note and like all this stuff so that there is protection, you know, for the seller and to make it so that it is a little bit more possible to deal with these challenges, which we did put these in place, which is one of the reasons I think it wasn't a complete freaking disaster. But a lot of people, you'll hear them talking about, like, oh yeah, I just went and like quit claimed the property to me. Like that's a great way to end up in a really weird spot, you know? And so, yeah, there's just like little things you do. And I mean, I would do it again. I mean, we were able to figure it out. So it's not that big of a deal. It was just a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Which is a lot of work.
I just contend that I wouldn't make this my only business model. Like somebody that was like an investor our size or smaller, they're like, yeah, you know, I only do sub twos. I got 10, 12 sub two properties that I'm, you know, cash flowing on. I'd be worried only because that's your only type of property. So if something does kind of go awry, like you're screwed. It's kind of like if you're a person that's like, oh, I have only short-term rentals. A lot of those people are kind of crying right now. They're like, oh, that was not a good move. I wish I would have had some long-term rentals mixed in and some other stuff. And that's not always, it's not always the case, but some people are the exceptions to the rule, I guess. However, just I don't feel comfortable with a transaction that is has so much gray area to have that be my only tool that I use to buy properties. And I think it's more so an issue is because you see a lot of people come in here with the no money strategy, which that's what they believe is a way to do it. And you can stumble up, you know, what do they say? Like a blind squirrel gets a nut once in a while if they search long enough. And it's like, if you do that, you know, you search long enough, you can find one and maybe do no money down and get this thing wrapped up and you could get yourself into trouble because you have, the seller has, you basically just have no ability to do much when you don't have money.
Correct. And you have no ability to even have a backup plan. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Like you can't bail yourself out. If you don't have money, you also don't have a track record. You can't go and like raise money all of a sudden.
You don't have reserves. You don't have, so it gets a little sketchy.
So yeah, I mean, it's all about understanding your options. And like, that's the difference between professionals and amateurs is knowing how to navigate different things, how to have the conversations. A lot of it honestly takes practice and kind of like learning as you go. I mean, like from these sort of things, when we first started doing off-market stuff, when we first started doing some of the creative financing things, we didn't know what was allowed and what wasn't. I remember like the first like seller finance and like more creative stuff that we did, we would literally just like write it onto the contract and then put it into escrow. And they'd be like, what are you trying to do? It's like, yeah, you can't do that. And we go, yeah. Oh, our bad. And we would just change it.
Yeah. Learned.
Yeah.
Just learn that one.
So, what am I doing?
We figure things out the hard way sometimes too. You know,
yeah.
Who knows? One thing that that I've been trying to have fun with is that note that we have a lead that came into our CRM. This is kind of a totally different topic, but also same because we're talking about mortgages. A seller finance note that from the mom of these kids, and they just want to sell. They don't want to sell the property. They want to sell the note.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been kind of an interesting, like, how do we buy this? Because obviously we're going to buy it at a discount if we bought it.
Yeah.
Or wholesaled it. I've never wholesaled a note before. If you know how to analyze notes or you're a note buyer, give us a call. Hit me up at InvestorMandan on Instagram or Mike_invest.
Yeah.
Because I would love to know, honestly. Yeah. But that's been kind of an interesting thing that I never thought I would have come across. But it's like, you know, I've always heard about people who are note buyers out there. And it just so happened that we found somebody wanting to sell a note just through our normal marketing campaign. That's been kind of interesting because my understanding is you have to buy them at a discount unless you're mm-hmm. okay with, this is a 5% note, for example. I wouldn't want to park money. This is a $70,000 balance.
Uh-huh.
My initial thought is like, well, you probably, I have no idea how to analyze the return right now, but you probably need to throw 50 grand at it or 45 grand, you know, to get a better return than 5%. But that's, I don't know. It's just kind of an interesting thought that it has, like, well, shoot, like, I wonder if you could search out seller financing loans, like as a data source.
Probably.
There might be an opportunity to market to people and say, hey, I'd love to buy your loan.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, you'd have a lot of cash to do it, I would think, but. I mean, there's probably ways.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of little notes like this. So this one's 70 grand.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, I know that was a fresh one that came in. So we can dive into that next week since we're at time. And we hopefully have a actual resolution for you on that.
I don't know if we will.
Yeah, we will. It might just like...
I don't know how to math it.
It might just fall off our radar because it ends up not being interesting in the next week. But
anyway,
check in.
Something else will take precedence.
Yeah, yeah. Check in next week and you can hear if we figure out how to buy this loan and exactly how the best way to do it is. So right on. Well, thanks guys for listening. We appreciate you all. You should go to collectingkeys.com/sub2. Get our free subject 2 course and we'll help you deal with the challenges that you can face if you have something unfortunate happen like we did or we have a loan get called. So yeah, awesome. Well, appreciate you all listening and we'll talk to you next week.